My pleasure.
Mrs. Barkhani Bela for stepping in like this. I really appreciate it. I want to thank Michael and Estelle Stein again for sponsoring this series. He's been, he's one of our trustees for many years, and he's been asking me to do this for about 2 decades. So thank you, Michael and Estelle. And I want to thank you all really for participating. You've made it a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying this. I love the interaction. I love the I love the spunkiness that everybody's in on it, and you're comfortable sharing learning together. This was my vision when I started this, when I did this series. I was hoping that it would turn into something like this, and it really is everything I hoped for. I hope you feel the same way. Just a note, in preparing tonight's talk, I looked carefully at all the information that I wanted to share with you. I did not want to rush through it, so I'm going to be doing another session next week at the same time, Tuesday night at 9:30 p.m. I have to send you a new invitation, so if you registered here, I have your information. I'll be sending out an email to the group with an invitation for next week. Again, it was really important material, and some of it I just felt we should spend more time really discussing it. One more thing on Rules of the Road, the way we set things up and the way you all voted for in a survey we did is that if you have a question, not a question, a what if question or anything else like that, if it's just clarification, what did you mean by this? Feel free to, you can just put up a digital hand or a hand, but only if it's something that you didn't understand. Other than that, we'll leave everything for the Q&A. Okay, let's get started. So the big idea was mentor or supervisor. That's something that we've been talking about throughout, and I'm gonna be mentioning it at the end of the talk again and a lot of it next week. And the big idea was that a supervisor is someone who supervises, you know, that you're there, you're setting the rules, which are important, and you're offering consequences if things don't work the way you like. But most people would not confide in a supervisor. It's just the way, that's the way it is, right? Very few people are gonna go over to the supervisor at work and say, oh, by the way, you know, I'm really messing up, or tell them some other personal problem that you have. Whereas a mentor, if you're fortunate to have one, a mentor is someone that you really do confide in, and you seek their guidance, and you actively appreciate that level of interaction. So we were talking about parenting our children, mentor, supervisor, or both, you know, how do we view our things, our roles here? And, you know, I've been encouraging you to think not only about a supervisor, there are some things that we have to do as supervisors, but think more as a mentor, so because that really allows you to parent your kids when they need it most. And again, we're going to be doing a lot of that next week, but it's a theme that we've been really working on throughout the sessions. Tonight's talk is called Bedrock, and what we're going to... I mentioned last week that we're going to be talking about Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs and how that relates to our parenting and our lives. And I'll just skip ahead to this for a moment. This is a theory by Abraham Maslow. The theory basically is, we just touched upon it very briefly last week, because last week we were talking mostly about personality profiles. And we were talking about how to find an answer key. How can you find an answer key? Meaning, if your child is not doing well, how can you find an answer key? How can you figure out what's going on? So we have, last week we talked about personality profiles and other things to look at. Today we're going to be talking about bedrock, about security, about safety, and about how to make your kids as comfortable as possible. First, we'll start with some scenarios. Bela, if I can ask you, I don't see my picture on the upper screen. It's probably a settings thing.
Can I spotlight you?
Yeah, no, yeah, to just like to have my, not just me. Yeah, okay, that's fine. Perfect. Okay, thank you so much, because I wanted it to come out in the recording, actually. Okay, thank you. So here are four scenarios. We're actually only going to cover one of them tonight and three next week. That's why I had to split them up to really do a deep dive into them. So scenario number one is our daughter was always a good student and a great kid. In the fall of 2019, the wheels seemed to have come off almost overnight, describing a very rapid decline. And we're going to talk, obviously, about that. And these are the things that we're looking for. Scenario number two is we're trying to separate our 11th grade son from bad friends, quote unquote. We haven't been very successful. Any suggestions? Scenario three, again, these are all very practical. Some of the things that some of you have sent in and some of the things that I've been doing for 40 years, you know, dealing with adolescence So scenario three is we found that our son's been drinking at Shalom Zachar. Shalom Zachar is a party in someone's home Friday night. If they have a son during the week, if they had a baby boy. So it's called a Shalom Zachar. And there's some alcohol there. He's been drinking. And he said, hey, listen, I'm not addicted. And number two, you know, look, I'll stop drinking out of the house if you just bring alcohol into the house. What do you do? Common scenario, but it's a big deal. And scenario four is our 19-year-old daughter is no longer Shabbos observant. She's our oldest. We're very concerned on how it will affect the younger siblings. Any suggestions? And we're going to be going into this. I like starting with the end in mind because, like as I've been saying all along, this theory and practice. So I think a good talk has a blend between theory, meaning why are we doing this, and tachlis, what should I be doing differently in Word or Excel, right? Like we talked about last week, is it, you know, a theory of why we're doing this? And then bottom line, what should I be doing in our home? It's nice how it's all of his theory, but like brass tacks, what am I doing about all of these things? So let's talk about Maslow. And honestly, folks, my dear friends, this is one of the most important things that you can, that I encourage you to think about as parents. I learned this many years ago in college. It's a one of the famous things they teach you in early psychology classes or other things like that, sociology. And basically his theory is that there are five sets of human needs and they're sequential, meaning you can't get to level two here. I'm using my cursor here, which is safety, without taking care of the physical needs. And so on and so forth. You can't really love and belong and have intimacy and friendship if you don't have one of those two. Self-esteem builds on after you have relationships, family, and self-actualization. In Yiddish, we call this the shteig, to be all you could be, like the head in the ad of the Marines. I had the great schus to be merit to be in chinuch and Jewish education, lived really for almost 40 years, and I've always thought about this as number one when I was trying to find the answer key for one of my students or people in my life, or later on dealing with teens at risk. And the way I think of it from the bottom up, so if a child is acting out, if a child is not actualizing, and they're not studying well, they're fighting around, their self-esteem is low, well, working your way backwards, they're having difficulty in their relationships with their friends, with their family. I always think to myself, three square meals a day, is the child being fed well? Are they getting enough sleep? Is everything in order in their physical life? Then how are they feeling safe? And again, we'll discuss details about this before getting to these other things. That's really how I trained myself to think like Maslow, and it hasn't served me wrong over the years. I found that this is really an extraordinary, like any theory, that you can poke holes in it and ask some questions about it. I can tell you a few questions that I have on it, but overall it's a very wise theory, and I think worthy of thinking about in so many ways as parents. Now let's give some practical examples, okay? Just a moment. Okay, so let's take example number one. I really am using these examples because Maslow's hierarchy of needs is going to be a real underpinning of what we're doing tonight and tomorrow and the next week. So I really want you to understand it well, and I want you to understand, in my opinion, it's something almost that you can't do anything about. It just is, because it's such an important facet of how our minds work and how our lives work. So Yukar breaks down on the, I'm reading from here on the left side, right? Example one, Yukar breaks down on the wrong side of the tracks. Yukar breaks down in a bad neighborhood. Yeah, I didn't write this here, but you have 2% on your battery, okay? Let's take the equivalent, you know, in today's vernacular of being really messed up, right? You have 2% on your battery, your car's broken down, you're really afraid for your life. So Maslow would say that you might have your biological and physiological needs, you may have that taken care of, you may have had a good meal, you're physically fine, but you're terrified. Now, your life coach, let's say you've been working with a life coach, and he or she has been talking about setting 5-year goals for yourselves. You know, you say, I'm not achieving everything I want to. You meet with this life coach, and he or she says, you know what, why don't you articulate 5-year goals for yourself? And we'll talk about it later in the week, okay? So now it was later in the week. You get a phone call, and this guy wants to, he or she wants to talk to you on the phone. Now, just imagine you're on the side of the road. You're feeling really, really unsafe. This guy comes along and wants to talk about five-year goals. 5-year goals is the fifth level here, self-actualization. You're not feeling safe. I could almost guarantee you that you're going to say something like, or think something like, 5-year goals, I don't know if I'll be alive in 5 minutes. So you really, physically, you can't get into a higher order thinking skill. You can't get into this self-actualization, which is beautiful, which is, it's Gan Eden, it's paradise when you get to grow like this, but you can't do it if it's not working right now, okay? So that's example number one, a practical example. You're not feeling safe. You're being schlepped in. Someone's trying to draw you into a level 3 conversation, a level 5 conversation, which is about self-actualizing. It's just not going to happen in all likelihood because your brain is not at ease. Here's a really practical example for parents. And this, you know, again, we're thinking about answer keys. I really encourage you to think about this example, not only in this facet, but in many, you know, many, many variations of this. Okay, mom says, sweetheart, please do your homework. And your daughter says, no, somebody's bullying me in school. Someone's hurting me on the bus, or someone's nasty to me and the thing. And you say, okay, sweetheart, why don't you do your homework and then we'll talk about it later. Maslow would say, again, there's a safety deficit. It's just, she might do it because she might not want to be punished, or she might want to, but you can bet your bottom dollar that she's not going to really be concentrating well. Okay, and you know, you could think about this thing with the car breaking down on the wrong side of the tracks. There's so many applications of this. Think of if you live in the New York area, how do you feel after Hurricane Sandy? Not having power for 5 days or 10 days. I remember myself, it was actually rather amusing. I happened to have been fortunate enough to get a generator before Sandy hit. And we actually had power at home. We lost all our power here in Muncie. Everybody did. And I was sitting there. I remember saying to myself, I was still in Yeshiva at the time. School was closed. I said, you know, this is Gan Eden. I can do all the writing projects that I wanted to. It's quiet. I have nowhere to go. There's no place to go. I can't go anywhere if I want to. There's no work. There's no nothing. And I found that I just didn't have the menucha, even though I had a generator working outside. And then, because I wasn't really settled. And then there was a gas shortage day 3 or 4. And that was just gone. Even though I had 2 full canisters of gas here, I kept hearing the generator ticking out there, thinking to myself, okay, soon I'm not gonna have power either. So this is really powerful stuff. So if your children have issues that they can't deal with, just understand that this is very real. Another application, I just thought of this in Yiddish, a farher means an examination. So I would do an oral examinations of my students. I would go into class and ask them questions about Chumash, about Gemara, you know, whatever they were learning at any given time. And I realized I had had an issue with one of my students that related to Maslow. And I don't know, I was thinking about it as I was walking in to test to Fahara class, to test one of the classes. And typically I would go around the room and ask random questions. And I remember saying to myself when I walked into the room, I said, Yankee, practice what you preach. If you're calling on kids, maybe the kids are not comfortable. Maybe they don't know all of the Gemara. And maybe when you call on them, you're creating anxiety. So I wrote here, what are they thinking about? So I'm trying to engage them, again, going back to Maslow here, I'm trying to engage them in self-actualization and in steiging and growing and all of that stuff. And they might really be nervous about being called on. And that I'm getting into a Tosfos, you know, commentaries on the Talmud and the Gemara, and the kids are thinking, okay, is he going up the rows or down the rows? Is he going by the alphabet, ABC? Is there some random system that he has? I haven't been called on in the last two fahers. Is it my turn now? So I walked into class. I said, all right, guys, you know what? We're going to start a new thing right now. Anybody could say pass. All you have to do is say pass. I won't hold it against you. I'll just assume that you didn't, you know, whatever you wanted to say, a different piece of Gemara. And I noticed that the whole class relaxed. And I got better quality answers and learning out of the kids. Okay, one final one, just a Torah source. I found this is my own thought. Feel free to disagree. This is only Yankee. There's a fascinating exchange in Parshas Va'era when Moshe Rabbeinu comes to take the Bnei Israel out of Egypt, and Hashem tells him, "Speak to the Jewish people, and they're going to listen to you." Now, Moshe Rabbeinu talks to them, and I'll give you the text in a minute. He says, basically, I'm going to take you out of the land of Egypt where they were being oppressed. It so happens that these are the four kosos, the four glasses of wine that we drink on Pesach, are the, we have Hatzesi, Vitalti, Vigalti, Lokachti. I'll take you out, I'll redeem you, I'll free you, and I'll bring you to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel. And it says, here's the text, Vayidaber Moshe Kenel B'nei Yisrael. This is what Moshe said. V'loy shamu al Moshe, the Jews didn't listen to Moshe, mikotzer ruach, they had short of breath, v'me'avodah kosher from hard work. So they didn't listen to Moshe. Moshe said, I'm going to take you out of here. And they said, they couldn't hear what he was saying. Why? Because they were oppressed. Now, one of the famous jails in New York area is called Rikers Island. Okay, it's a pretty rough place there. Now, just get this in your mind now. Imagine a delivery truck pulls up and the guy whispers, he sees two inmates there and he says, hey, guys, come on over here. Jump in the back of the truck. No one checks me on the way out. And okay, so they have a 25-year sentence. They have an opportunity for freedom. And the guy, they suddenly say, oh, well, one second, just a minute now. The warden is making me crazy. You know, these guards are bothering me. Forget it, I can't come. Right, that would be a reason to jump on the truck. So they didn't listen to Moshe Rabbeinu because they were short of breath. They couldn't relax. So that should have been a reason that they should listen. So I want to suggest as follows. Listen to Moshe speaking and think of Maslow, okay? Moshe Rabbeinu says like this, I'm gonna redeem you from Mitzrayim. That's number one or two, right? I'll get you freedom and you'll be saved. V'tzalti eschem, I'll save you from the hard work. I'll redeem you, v'ga'alti eschem. Now, then he starts, I would like to suggest, Moshe Rabbeinu jumps to five, and he starts talking to them, I'll bring you, you'll become my nation, and Hashem will be your God, and I'll bring you to the land of Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel. I believe that that's when he lost them. The first three they were fine with, but that's my own interpretation, that they lost them because it was just too much. Okay, so again, I'm sorry I spent this much time with different examples, although some of you wanted it in the survey, but it's so important that you understand that it's almost like a rule of nature that gravity brings things, you know, down towards the earth. It just doesn't work. And the more you can think about looking at something and thinking what's going on here, the better you'll be able to help your kids. I happen to have realized this in my own, my eureka moment was when I realized about 18 years ago that so many children were being abused because, and this is something for parents to think about, not chas v'shalom only about abuse, but children being in a bad spot. I had a group of people that I was dealing with and trying to figure out why the kids were self-destructing. And it seemed, according to Maslow, I knew some of these families, everything seemed right. And they were still self-destructing. And I remember thinking to myself, what would Maslow say? This doesn't make sense. It's like they got destroyed from within. And I said, oh my goodness, they were molested. And I called the parents and they all said, no, it's not true. And then they checked and every one of those kids had been abused. That's when I started writing about it. So going back to the situation where we had this scenario number one, I found over the years that when you see a rapid decline, you see, if you notice that, remember last week I was saying, you know, listen carefully, that Hasidic parent who spoke to me about their kid was in the room and what wasn't coming out for anything. And I said, listen carefully, what exactly did he say? He said that it's all words to me. And they're learning the same thing again and again. This is a big deal. When you see children, a rapid decline, it's very, very likely trauma related. So my advice to parents, if you're looking, if it's a child of yours, if it's something that doesn't seem to make sense and you see a tremendous decline, like almost overnight or over the period of a few weeks, I would encourage you. It doesn't necessarily mean child abuse. It doesn't necessarily mean sexual abuse, but it usually is a trauma related because it's so much harder for them to concentrate on where we are. And here's one of my main points tonight, is I encourage you to think of your role as parents to provide those two levels. So because we want our children to have family connection with us and you know, eventually, God willing, you know, intimacy, where they find, get into a loving relationship with their spouse, and they have family connections and friendships because we want them to have that. And because we want them to going up the ladder, right? To have respect, status, recognition, self-esteem, to feel good about themselves and to be all they could be. That's not the only reason you should do it, but I really encourage us to you to think as parents, not only providing for the physiological needs, but providing them with a sense of safety. And I encourage you to think about that as one of your primary roles. And I just want to talk to you about child safety. I'm not going to spend that much time on this, but I do want to go through, excuse me, the family component of child safety and the community component of child safety. Some of this you may have heard. I don't believe that you've heard that much on the community, and I think it's really, really, really important that you think of it in those terms also. So let's get to it. So the family child safety component, excuse me, is educating your children about child safety education. Let me just make a note now to remember in the email when I send out the video, the YouTube video of this talk, I'll send you a 9-minute video it's a free video that talks about child safety in greater detail. Excuse me. And, you know, there are lots of sources that you can use to learn about it. So what you basically, child safety, the experts in the field say that these are the child safety messages. Now, this doesn't have to do with supervision. That's a separate thing. In other words, this isn't everything related to child safety. But, you know, I've been doing talks on this for over 15 years. And, you know, I studied at the feet of the top people in the film world and in child abuse prevention and the like, and people in the non-Jewish world. And these were the things that came up about messages to children. Number one is no secrets from parents. To teach your children that no one's ever allowed to tell them to keep a secret from you. Your body belongs to you, which is overall the concept of self-ownership, that you own, you know, your body is something of yours. I'm going to go over each of these in a little bit more greater detail. We'll discuss a little bit more about what that looks like. Good touching, bad touching. Some touching is okay, some touching is not okay. One way to say this, for example, is some place covered by a bathing suit is not appropriate to be touching, and no one has the right to make you feel uncomfortable. Message number four is more complicated than the others because it's more complicated than the others because it's not as clear and crisp as the other ones. And I'll just go, let me just go through these. So message number one, no secrets. Predators don't want children speaking to their parents regularly. Okay. Obviously, you know, one of the Supreme Court justices famously said that if you want to catch a thief, you have to think like a thief. So think like a predator. The abusers, the worst thing for them, I mean, one of the things they're afraid of is that the children will tell their parents. So that's something by establishing regular contact and talking to your children regularly, get them in the habit when they come home to share their day with you. They can talk to you about anything. That's something you can start very young. And someone telling your children to keep a secret from you is a huge red flag. No one should ever do this. I was a school principal, I'm a rabbi. I should never, ever, ever be telling a student of mine, you know, this is between us. So this is a real red flag. So you tell your children, if somebody does tell you to keep secrets from us, that's a no, please tell us, and we'll be very grateful that you came. Okay, your body belongs to you is the concept of the ownership of their space. Look at the second bullet I said here. Think, how old does a child have to be to understand the concept of ownership? Very young, right? Your children know at a very young age, what their blankets, you know, their pacifiers, their favorite, they know almost like very, very young that things belong to them. So you train them that they belong to them. And especially in the Orthodox Jewish world where we spend so much time, these wonderful messages that we should continue to teach about sharing, about tzedakah, about the charity, about respect for elders, about respect for people in the clergy or rabbanim or leaders of the community or school principals. So all of those things are good. You shouldn't tell your children not to respect them. But because of that, you teach them that they have this concept of ownership of themselves. And the research shows that even having a designated drawer at home, even something as small as that, makes children more likely to protect themselves when something comes up. This is a page from our child safety book. It's called Let's Stay Safe. And this is just a page, this is the only page from the book I had, but just to see the concept, right? I have the ball, I have my knapsack, I have stuff that's mine. My body is also private, okay? And it's important to note that the research shows that we're not supposed to frighten our children when we have these conversations with them because, Maslow would say, right? Their brains shut down if we frighten them. So it should be a relaxed conversation. Dr. David Palkowitz always said a moderate amount, like from 1 to 10, a 2 or a 3 or 4 maybe. In other words, important enough to know that it's not like don't chew with your mouth open. It's more serious than that. But you know, if you say it with the anxiety that you feel, it's going to be too much and you'll bug the kids out. Okay, so that's a concept of self-ownership. Good touching, bad touching. Anything covered by a bathing suit is a good way to do this. Anything covered by a bathing suit is private. And this is really important to list exceptions to the rules very carefully. I'm just making another note to send you boundaries. I did a talk with the police chief of Tenafly, New Jersey. And he was absolutely brilliant, and he gave a number of rules about this. I'll send you the link to his video. But the exceptions, the reason you have to list exceptions very carefully is sadly, and I know really none of us want to believe it, we can't believe it, but it just is, you know, most of the abuse takes place from people in our inner circle, often family. So if you say something like, no one's allowed to touch you in a private spot except for people in our family, you're setting yourself up for problems that, you know, that might, chas v'shalom, turn south if somebody in the family wants to chas v'shalom harm them. So what you say is much more like only mommy and daddy, Abba and Ima, a babysitter when we're not here, Bubby, grandma, if she's watching you, a doctor during a visit, very, very tight and very limited so that children will know it's only that. And here, as I mentioned, this last one is a little more difficult to convey, and it's no one has the right to make you feel uncomfortable. And that's really an idea, so it's not as simple as the other one. The other ones, I'm making a note to send you an article I wrote called The Halo Effect. And the concept is, this is actually, the police chief said exactly these words. He said, it, not whom, meaning that you train yourself to think that if somebody's doing something and the thing isn't right, but the person is right. Let me refer it differently. I'm sorry, maybe I perhaps wasn't clear. When we make a value judgment, we usually put two things together. We take two things together. One is the action. The second is who did that action. And there's a whole discussion going on in our great country about this concept of it, not whom, as it relates to African Americans, are they being mistreated? I'm not going into the details. I think social justice is important, and I think I certainly hope our imperfect democracy moves forward to becoming more and more perfect as time goes on. But that's the concept. The folks are saying that it's the whom. You're judging me by the way I look, not by what I did. So here's a much softer example of the concept. The concept is that you take the action and you take the person who did it, and you make those two, you evaluate and you decide how nervous you should be, like how much of a, how do you grade this? So here's a simple example. Let's say you walk into a shul one morning. Okay, you walk into synagogue one morning. Remember that shul? You walk into shul in the morning, you're the second person in shul. The first person is standing near the Aron Kodesh, near the Ark, and he's taking single dollar bills out of a charity box. Okay, that's what you saw. That's the it. Now, the whom is a very distinguished person in the community. So you take the it, that looks pretty suspicious, taking money out of a charity box, out of a tzedakah box. The whom was somebody respected. It's your friend, your best friend. You know him for 30 years. So you say, okay, the thing doesn't look good, but he did it, can't be. So you put the two of them together and you say, nothing to worry about. The guy probably put a $20 bill in right before I came in and he's taking change, okay? If it's somebody that looks suspicious, you'll pick up a phone and call the police, okay? You saw the same thing, you mixed it with who did it, okay? And the halo effect, if you're interested in looking up on it, I'm going to send you an article. I wrote it during the Nehemiah Weberman trial. The halo effect basically means the halos, like angels, mythically have that, it's represented like that in imagery, that they have a halo around their heads. The halo effect means it was researched on originally in the army, that if people look a certain way and they're put together and they're handsome and they're, attractive, they're well-dressed, you're less likely to think that they did something wrong. So it was originally done a sergeant's evaluations. They were giving better evaluations to the handsome soldiers than the ones who didn't look that put together. And the halo effect becomes very dangerous because we say it can't be that disparate. We have that same reaction. God forbid, whenever there's a scandal, so many times, I always say it's not the fellow in the raincoat that had, the weirdo in the raincoat, so to speak, a maladjusted person that does abuse, although that happens, but it's very rare. It's much more likely to be a charming person. And when it's somebody you respect, you say, it can't be. Here's another example of the halo effect that I often use. If you're in shul and the Baal Kriya, the one who reads the Torah, For those who aren't familiar, that the Torah doesn't have the Torah scroll doesn't have punctuation. So somebody reads the weekly portion, the Torah, the Parashat Shavua, from the Sefer Torah. Now imagine you have a superstar Baal Kriya, Baal Kari, as it's called, and never made a mistake in 30 years, and he makes a bad mistake one day. I know what I would do. I could almost guarantee you that you're not going to raise your voice and say, hey, you made a mistake. Why? Because you're going to think to yourself, he hasn't made a mistake in 30 years. Maybe his grandfather had a different custom, so I'm not going to make a fool out of myself and yell in public and say, hey, even politely, you know, you made a mistake, because he never makes mistakes. This is what happens when we get into trouble. We get into trouble when we start making these assumptions about people based on the halo effect. And finally, this thing about being uncomfortable, this is, folks, this is my, I'll try to remember to send you a link to this also. This is my number one recommendation for an article. I'm not talking about books or research papers, an article written by Malcolm Gladwell, the one who wrote Tipping Point and you know, Blink and Outlier and other books like that. So he wrote an article, it was a New Yorker magazine called In Plain View. It's a must read for every parent. Some of it might make you a little queasy, might take away your lower levels of Maslow, but it's really important. And what he talks about is how, this is Jerry Sandusky, there was a terrible scandal in Penn State University. Joe Paterno was a beloved coach, by all accounts, a very decent man, cared about the kids, was in scholarships for them, and you know, made sure he was supposed, you know, certainly seemed like a wonderful person. There was a guy under him, Sandusky, who was a terrible abuser, and he got away with abusing kids for many years. And Malcolm Gladwell talks about how the grooming process works. You can see him even at the beginning, he talks about a fellow named Clay, and I really encourage you to read it to see how the grooming process works. So therefore, it's something that I just encourage you to think about. Again, those four messages and the reasons we say them all. I want to talk to you about communal safety, because I don't think there's enough discussion about this. And folks, these next few minutes, honestly, I think it's worth the whole talk just for this. How safe is your community? I'm asking all of you. I know some of you I got to know, but I certainly don't know most of you well. I really encourage you to think about it. I have my own chiddush, my own idea of how to assess this, but I can tell you, folks, from my experience, not all communities have the same abuse rate. And it's logical that they wouldn't, because it depends what they do. It depends what the leadership does. How can you assess your community's risk level? And it's important, because where you live makes a big difference. And if it's not in order, try to do something. Or if you're thinking about moving and selecting, give this assessment tool. This is Yankee's take on it, folks. This is such an emotional subject, this whole child abuse thing, as it should be. And it's very difficult to have a rational conversation about it. So I was thinking to myself, how can I make this point with no emotion? How can I do it with only Excel and no word? And I came up with this idea of making an assessment tool. So here's the example. How do you calculate car insurance premiums? Okay, you go to Geico, you go to any one of the main companies, or not so main companies, and you say, how much is my premium gonna be? So they'll ask you these questions, or they'll look up your record. You know, how many accidents or claims did you make in the past 5 years? What's your driving record? How many moving violations did you have? What's your zip code? Are there a lot of thefts, a lot of stealing of cars in your neighborhood? Do you have teenage drivers at home? How many of them? We once had 4 teenage drivers. You can imagine what our insurance rates were at the time. So this is an assessment tool that the company, the underwriters of this policy, it's not personal. It's not Word. It's all Excel. It's just numbers. but they feed these numbers into a program. There's an algorithm that kicks out a premium depending on how high risk you are or low risk you are. Okay, here's where the rubber meets the road, folks. Here's the Yankee take on this. Imagine if you had a health insurance plan, okay? You had with one of the large, you know, Oxford, Aetna, you had a regular policy for a regular health plan. And there are riders, you know, there's a rider, and I mean, rider means like something extra. There's a dental insurance rider, you know, you can buy for extra money, you pay for dental insurance. How about if there was a premium that a family paid in case, God forbid, chas v'shalom, if one of the children were abused, they would get free treatment for life. Okay, that's the policy. You take a regular health insurance policy, you have some other policies that you take, but there's a rider there that gets the family coverage, drug rehab, chas v'shalom, whatever it is, if a child is abused. How does that adjuster evaluate your community? What would he ask? Remember these questions that we had here? Folks, I think this is the most important takeaway from tonight. Okay? The car insurance, no emotion. These are the questions they ask. If I was an adjuster and they asked me to assess risk, these are the things I would say. How safe is your community? Is there ongoing child safety education? I hope you're answering great answers to all of these. Okay? Do the children get educated? Is there training for teachers? Is there training for employees of schools and shuls and other institutions, day camps, summer camps? Are abusers reported to the authorities? If they're not reported to the authorities, of course the abuse rate's gonna be higher. I would certainly charge a lot more money if I was the insurance company, if I heard that abusers are watched by the, you know, are not reported to the authorities, you bet you bet a dollar that the insurance, the abuse rates are going to be higher there. Do abuse victims receive emotional communal support, meaning they're more likely to come forward? Are they getting professional treatment? So I can list you other things like this, but this is the big idea. And as uncomfortable as it may be for you, I really encourage you to think about not just your family, but your community. Is your community doing all it should in these areas? And I venture to say that if they're not, just again, take the emotion out of it. I didn't say anything about any community specifically. I purposely didn't. Although I have suspicions, and, you know, I can't stop my mind from wandering knowing what I know. But just take that all out. Just do it like a car insurance. Say, is our community doing everything we should? Are there protocols in schools? I didn't include this. There are other things I could say. Protocols means is a Rebbe, am I as a school principal, or is it when I was a Rebbe, should I be taking a kid out for a Slurpee? What's the school policy on that? Does your school have a child school have a policy? Not looking to make trouble, folks. I'm just trying to keep your kids safe. So does the school have a policy? Is a Rebbe, is it appropriate for a teacher to take a child home alone in a car? Kid misses the bus. Should a teacher take the child home if they're alone by themselves? Do bar mitzvah tutors, is it the culture that they go only in a public place or only to the child's home, let's say, while the parents are there? Or do they, you know, go to a shul or a place that they're alone? I don't think anyone should be alone with a child. I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think the Slurpee thing is a good idea. It might be nothing. It might be grooming activities, we don't know. I certainly don't recommend that teachers and faculty members do this, but if you have protocols in the schools, then the rules are very clear. So again, I'll be glad to take questions. I imagine we might get a question or two on this, feel free. Again, the stakes are too high, my dear friends. We spent, this is our sixth night together. I care for you, I care for your children. I'll take pot shots if someone wants to take some at me for saying this. I don't care, really. I'm much more important that your children stay safe. So think about it. It doesn't mean if it's not being done that the people are terrible people. Maybe they didn't think about it. It wasn't like this when I started teaching. It wasn't like this 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Very few people had protocols. You know, there wasn't child safety education on this level, but times have changed. And if you find this odd, I'll be glad to take specific questions later. And if you have a question that you want to ask like this, feel free to black your picture or change your name now so that, just write anonymous or whatever it is, so you can ask an honest question. But I would say that if these things are not in order in your community, try to make it better. See if you could offer to help. See if you could offer to be of assistance in any way. Come to the school head and say, look, I would love to help pay for child safety training. I'll be glad to get some friends of mine together to pay for it. Think of it in those terms, but really assess your community's, level. And the research says that I purposely, on the bottom it says, citations provided at the end of this. I'll stop the slideshow at the end and talk about that. These are things that research shows doesn't mean kids will get abused, but they're more likely to be. What's the neighborhood's attitude about reporting? There is studies on this. I'm reporting suspected abuse to the authorities, and it's perfectly logical. The abusers know they're evil and they're very good at this grooming thing, and they know which communities are not going to say anything. Unavailability or lack of social services, meaning support for families. Parents unavailable to children because, their employment or other reasons, meaning that if the supervision of the children is weaker, there's a higher instance of abuse. Again, these are things that the insurance adjuster would say. Lack of support from family and friends for childcare and emotional connection. Unfortunately, the abusers tend to flock or to go to people who don't have that level of emotional support, people who are loners, who don't, kids who are loners or adults. Again, if you have any questions on this, I'll be delighted. Not delighted, it'll be my honor to help. And high level of financial stress. So all of these things, again, all of these things are stressors. And so the first thing that the message was, we were talking about these scenarios. This first one, I said, if you see something, part of, last week we were talking about educational stuff, let's talk about social emotional issues this week and next week. And let's talk about realizing that when you see something, go from 0 to 60, chas v'shalom, or from 60 to zero. That's what I listen to on the phone or email when people call. And, they say, well, our son is having that. Well, when did it start? Was it over 2 years or was it sudden? If you hear something sudden, then it's probably trauma related or very likely to have been trauma related. And what's so important about this is if that is the case, virtually any intervention other than love, support, and counseling will be counterproductive. So it's so important that you set things up, that you're able to talk and listen and find out what's going on. Because if you see things like this, there is stuff going on. This is what we're going to be talking about next week. And that's why I really wanted to give it its own night. Okay, this is an iceberg. The vast majority of the iceberg is underwater. It has to do with flotation and all of that in science. So next week we're going to be talking about what you see and what you can only learn if your kid confides in you. And this goes back to the supervisor and mentor thing that we talked about. This area on top is what you wind up seeing. The social, emotional, I see my child is having, let's say, quote unquote, bad friends, or they stop going to shul, that you see. Do you see substance abuse? Are you seeing self-destructive behaviors? Are you seeing, this is below the surface. And next week we'll talk about that blend of dealing with it, how to find out about it. We spoke already about, having your kids talk to you. But this is really where I see this, the next week's talk going. this was a research summary. If you remember, we did this in when we talked about Would Your Kids Tell You? These are five attributes of families that, what do families do who children confide in them, right? There's a level of trust, there's validation, parents don't freak out when they're told things, close relationships. It's not likely that you'll be able to develop this overnight. It's something that you invest in, being open and flexible, and time together as a family dynamic. All of this is research-based. And this is what we're gonna be talking about next week, the bottom of the iceberg, okay? So we're gonna talk about being a parent who gets it, meaning to really start looking at the world and your family and your children in a very different light, being attuned to the facts of what's really going on. And that includes marking the back of your liquor bottles, a lot of very pragmatic things to start looking and finding out what's really going on, giving you the tools to effectively deal with the underwater stuff. And number three is a real issue. I'm certainly not minimizing it. It's how to parent a child who disappoints you and perhaps breaks your heart. And that is, you know, that's been, you know, our Torah didn't cover up on anything. You know, the Torah discusses the struggles that our greatest, our avos and imais, our patriarchs and matriarchs, the Chumash, the Torah did not cover up on challenges that they had with their children. I'm really gonna spend quite a bit of time on number three, talking about in a practical way, what you can do as parents to try to, how to, you know, on an emotional way, how to do it, and in a very practical way, how to do it, okay? So here's the research citations. So again, just to sum up, we were talking about, at the beginning, we were talking about those four scenarios. We concentrated on one. We're talking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and to think to yourself, what's going on that I don't see? Everything makes sense. There's always an answer key. Is Maslow's theory open to this type of interpretation? If you ask me, I had one story, many, but one in particular during Q&A, if you're interested, I'll be glad to share that other story with you, but it's so powerful and it's so profound. So include the social emotional piece in addition to the learning things and the things we talked about last week. Think about the social emotional piece and see how that can possibly provide you with an answer key so that you can more effectively help your children. Again, if you don't know what's going on, right? This is the whole point, right? If you can't figure out what's going on in some of these scenarios, it's very likely that you're not, I mean, how could you really expect to be able to deal with it effectively? Okay, so lean into next week, we have a full agenda, and I look forward to seeing you then. I'll be glad to take any questions. Layla?
I don't see any hands raised.
Okay, folks, if anybody has any questions, it does not have to be only about tonight. This is a cumulative exercise. Feel free. Batsheva has a hand up.
Yep. Again. Batsheva, you're unmuted.
Go ahead, Batsheva. I'm going to turn off screen. I'm going to turn off screen sharing, and let's go. Good evening, everyone. Let's go.
Hi.
Hello.
So, based because of my family, a lot of family, a difficult family situation, it was suggested that my daughter get like a mentor to spend time with her.
Right.
Like a girl. Is there any issue with that? I mean,
you mean should you be concerned?
Yes.
Is it part of an organization? You don't have to say the name. I'd rather you don't say the name, but is it part of an organization?
Yeah, it would be recommended by an organization.
So here's having run a teen mentoring program for about 12 years, we had a few hundred. You know, this was back in the day, you know, when there were very few agencies helping, you know, families and kids like this. So we ran a teen mentoring program. So I think the should I tell you, you know, my heart wasn't in my throat all the time worrying about something, God forbid, the, you know, an unspeakable thing happening. I absolutely was. But what I would tell you to do is find out about the training. And, you know, the same advice, by the way, if you're sending your child to summer camp or day camp or school, and you want to know, there's nothing wrong with you asking in a general way, what training do you offer your staff? And if you ask a head counselor, for example, of a summer camp, if you're thinking of, I know in New York, there's a whole, you know, camps, no camps, whatever. But, you know, if you're looking into a summer camp, I always tell parents, say, I'm not sending my kid to camp, everybody's abusing. I said, listen, you can't do this. You know, your kids have to live life. You just have to be careful. So I tell parents to ask the head of the camp, what training do you give your staff? What do you tell do you speak to the children that if they're uncomfortable, there's someone that they should go to? And that person should not be the head counselor. It should be usually somebody outside the, you know, outside the hierarchy of the organization. Now that they could go to a leadership person, but they also should be able to go to somebody who's like outside that. And that's good practice, is that they should say this, you know, on the first day when you have orientation with the children, you tell them, look, this is a safe place. If anybody feels uncomfortable, you can come to me, you can come to him, you can come to her, whatever. So if you ask the head of the camp and they say, what training do you do? And they say, oh, Baruch Hashem, we never have any trouble. Folks, run for the hills, okay? So, but in your case, as far as the mentoring program goes, ask them how they're trained. What's their policy? I know you're getting a favor from them, so you don't want to come across, you know, like you're just busting their chops and you're just giving them a hard time. But these are fair questions. You know, what's your policy? A good program has training, and usually there's a form that has that they have to fill out every time they're with the mentee. They fill out a basic report, and the parents are involved, and you know, so it's a process. I certainly would not tell you to drop the mentor because you're afraid, but you should find out as best you can what's going on, how the program deals with this. That would be my advice. And if they don't have a training program, and if they don't, I'm not saying you should say no. You know, it's hard to take away what you can't replace, but I'm just saying, you know, I would be concerned if they don't have any training and supervision, both training at the beginning and supervision where they get to talk over how it went. Did I answer your question?
And when you mean specifics about the training, if they talk about this, like if, are they making?
I don't know if you can, if they're comfortable, if the organization says, you know, here's our training manual, that's great. If they don't, you say, look, you know, what do you speak to the, what, you know, you don't even have to start with the abuse thing. You say, I just want to know, and like, what's your policy about confidentiality? If my daughter talks to her mentor, and there's something I should be concerned about, should I be notified? Is there a strict rule that I'm not supposed to be notified? To start there, that's a much more neutral way. Okay. So I'd like to know the rules of the road. In our organization, when Project Yes, when we did this, we used to have a meeting with, you know, a lot of people, they do it like, yeah, let's not, you know, you don't want to make them uncomfortable that they're being mentored, let them meet in shul, or they'll meet over there in the park or whatever. And like you have two sets of books, so to speak, you know, you don't make clear what the, I'm sorry? You know what I'm saying?
No, like, I'm listening.
Like you don't make it clear what the rules of the road are. Like, and what we used to do is we most of what we got from Big Brothers Big Sisters of New York and other organizations that we studied. I actually hired somebody to spend a few months researching best practices before. I was terrified to do this. I wanted to do it because it needed to be done. But we actually, you know, they say if you take someone's writing, it's plagiarism. If you take writing from many people, it's called research. You know, so I had somebody do research for us, but these are the best practices, and like I said, if the best setting, that's what the research shows, is that, not my research, you know, their research, that we used to have a meeting, and we, in front of the child, the head of the program would be with the mentor and the mentee and the mentee's parents. And they would explain, here's how it's going to work. You're going to spend an hour together. they would say some rules of the road, and they would say, listen, if you want to speak in confidence, then you can speak to your mentor in confidence and ask him not to tell the parents. Parents, are you okay? If you're not okay, tell us, then it's not going to work. You know, so this, the best situation would be if there's this type of training, transparency, and say they're in order. Okay, anything else? Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay, good for you. Stay spunky. Good, look it up. Go ahead, anybody else, folks? Early night, I can go golfing. It's dark outside. Anything else, folks? Shia, is that your hand? No golfing, it's too dark. Do you want to say something? Go ahead. Josh?
You have to unmute yourself. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think I did. Did I?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you
okay.
My star student.
Oh, good. You yes. Say that now.
I'll let you know.
Go ahead. I had a question. I had a question on the community assessment tool that Rebbe put on the screen before. So one of the points was said to see if does your community report abusers or does abuse get reported to the authorities, whatever the exact wording was. So that could be something that might be difficult to know necessarily. How would you say to, could you elaborate a little bit more on what do you mean by that point? Exactly. How would you?
Well, right. So it's really a culture thing. You know, some shuls do have, like I said, there's a protocol. You know, the one if any of you are interested in looking into this, you know, looking into, you know, getting protocols, there's some really good work being done. You know, the first shul that I looked at their protocols was the Young Israel of Woodmere. You can look it up on, you know, they had one many, many years ago. That Dr. Salomon was involved in, Avi Lauer from Yeshiva University, they were involved in drafting it for the shul. And there are very, very clear policies about training for the staff, you know, for the youth groups and what protocols are and what you do and what you don't do, who to go to if you're not, like, they have a real protocol. So that's very clear. But in some communities, the culture is that it's kind of frowned upon to go to the authorities. Thank God it's much less than it used to be. When I started working in this child safety space, it was like a big deal. You know, not everybody was, a lot of folks were not comfortable reporting. So I don't know, Yeshua, I don't know if there's a, Josh, if there's a sign up there that says, you know, reporting is us, you know? But you can kind of get a flavor for what the attitudes are. Speak to people in leadership if you're not sure. Say, what's the policy? You know, ask the rabbi of a shul, it's psychic. Look, what do you think about, what's your policy on this? What are your thoughts about this? If you want to, but like some places there's unfortunately, there still are vestiges of hostility when people come forward or the victim comes forward and nobody believes her or him. You know, so all of that ties into it. So again, Josh, I wasn't writing only those things, and it's not, you know, punching these numbers it's just about getting a feel for it. A similar thing I did for this, if you look on my website, I believe in giving people the information to make the choice themselves. I was very upset at the time when I started dealing with teens at risk in 1997. So not you, you know.
You had me, and then you realized. But
that's right. So you know, people were sending kids to yeshiva and to Eretz Yisrael without, you know, I thought without many situations without doing the diligence, and they were just like, you know, sending them to Israel because the guy around the block, you know, he was a wild kid. He was doing drugs. He went to Israel. The tzitzis came out, you know, and now he's stark and he's, you know, whatever. So, you know, I was trying to convey this to parents, don't send all kids to Israel. So I made an assessment tool. You click it on my website. I have a whole list to send you guys. It's a way of thinking about this whole thing. So what I did is I made an assessment tool. I said, okay, my son is 16. 16 is 5 points, 17 is 4 points, you know, 20 is 0 points. My kid has a learning disability, 10 more points. You know, my kid hates rules, you know, so all of the, and you add it up at the end and you see, you know, if you're above a certain number, it's probably not going to work. Okay, so that's just how my mind works. Like, rather than you come to me, yes, Rabbi Horowitz, what do you think? You know, I would much rather let you know how I think and you make this decision yourself. So I'm just giving you these attributes. Think to yourself, would an abuser be comfortable here? You know, Rabbi Glasser from Yeshiva University, he was an abuser in his shul in Passaic. He actually asked me to, a woman in the community had a child who was a registered sex offender. Rabbi Yaakov Glasser, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I know him very well, I work with him.
Yeah, send him my best, please. So he asked me to come speak to, so this guy was released from jail and he wound up coming home to his mother's house. He was an adult, but the place went into a panic. So the first thing he did was he asked me to come down and speak to them, to the parents. That's right. That's sending a message, right? That's what I mean, Josh. So the rabbi's getting up and sending a message that, hey, we're gonna keep our eye on this. We're not going to drop the ball. So that's a message. And what I found amazing, I was so moved when I heard about it. I heard from one of the people in the shul that this guy was told in no uncertain terms not to come to shul. He walked in while the Rav was in the middle of Shema, Kriya Shema, of Meir, Friday night. And he interrupted his Shema. He stopped davening, went over to the guy and spoke to him in the middle of his own davening. He said, leave the shul now. You're not welcome here. You're a sex offender. You cannot be around children. That is a message to everybody. So I'm saying sometimes people give these messages to people who report, you know, and they make them uncomfortable. So it's the gestalt of it all. It's you look at it and you say, which components are here? Would a sex offender be comfortable here? Or would they say, this is not the place for me? Okay, that's really what it's about. Did I answer your question, sir?
Yes.
Now, I should do Excel, your wife's word, right?
Exactly.
It would be so meaningful if you just, you know, looked at the shul and thought about it. I'm just kidding. Okay, anybody else? Go ahead.
Abish Rand has a question.
Yes. Go, please.
Abish, you have to unmute yourself.
Can he? Oh, you unmuted him.
I unmuted.
Here we go. Yes. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Baruch Hashem. So we have what to catch up on, but right now I just wanted to thank you.
Oh, Ma, hey, how are you doing? How are you? I don't see your picture here.
Here, 1 second. Here we go. Let's get that started.
Oh, okay. From Lichem. West Coast? West Coast?
Yeah, West Coast.
Careful. Watch the corona thing. Wear a mask.
Yeah, seriously. I don't worry. I'm wearing
one. Oh, by the way, Yeshua, Josh, while we're at it, I know you're muted. It's okay. Stay muted. It's fine. This, your wife told me to say that. No, this mask here, you talk about culture. This mask, okay. I'm not wearing a mask. I'm the only guy in the room right now. This is my culture. I walk around with this in my pocket. Okay? That's a message. I'm sending a message that I think anybody who tells people not to wear a mask is a madman.
Because like Rabbi says, real men wear masks.
Oh, you're right.
That's right.
I had it before, what's her name there? You know, the Cheney's daughter. I had it first. Yeah, but this is, I'm sorry, Abish, I'll be with you, Rabbi Abish, I'll be with you in a second.
That's fine.
But this is a culture thing. This is a culture thing. I'm sending a message here that I think people who don't wear masks are selfish and hard, you know, depending on the situation, and people who give advice that people shouldn't wear masks are it's an abomination. I think it's just a horrible, horrible thing. So this is my message. So it's a culture thing. I'm sending up a message. This is what I believe in. I believe real men wear masks. I'm not saying I'm a real man, but you know, I'm saying real men wear masks. So this is a culture thing. I'm sorry. Abish, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that after the first, I think it was the first or second session, where you talked about kids acting up, and someone mentioned something you had said years ago about kids from abused homes don't fight. So
I didn't say it exactly like that. Right. About this, there's less sibling rivalry.
Right. Yeah, I'm saying I know I'm misquoting it right now.
Right. Okay, I just want to say right. I said that the research shows it doesn't mean they never do, but
right. There's
typically less sibling rivalry, not just abusive homes, in homes that Maslow would say their physical needs aren't taken care of, you know, or their safety is not that secure. They don't have the comfort to quarrel, or The other theory was that the currency of their parents' love and attention isn't worth much. So there's not that they're really fighting about. I'm sorry.
That's good. But Bekitzer, that after hearing that discussion, especially what you're just saying, the currency of the parents is not so valuable. So I had been struggling with something with my kids because, we're, whatever, not to drop bombs, but I'm in the middle of a divorce. And whenever I'm with my kids, I found that they were just bickering and shepherding and what is going on? Every time, you know, they switch, you know, parents or whatever. I don't know the other side, but when they were ever with me, I couldn't figure out like why are they going so crazy? And after that class, that's when this is my shkayach. After that class, all of a sudden it hit me that they just want my attention. They just want to make sure that I'm still, you know, I'm still, you know, when Yitzchak said to Avraham Avinu, you know, he says Hineni Bini, right? He turns to his father and he says, "Are you still there? Are you still my father?"
Right. Because he saw that he wanted to kill him on the Bad Day Akedah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just want to tell you that, you know, I've always felt. First of all, thank you for being courageous, you know, speaking about it. It's good. I never felt that kids, I think I said this earlier in a session, you know, that you know, obviously I'm a little biased because I came from a blended family, but I don't think that kids are from blended families, divorced parents, you know, orphans. I don't think that like it's an automatic that they're going to be, God forbid, you know, maladjusted or anything. I think it really has to do with the attitude of the parents. And, you know, I think kids from unhappy homes and stressful homes are much more at risk. But, you know, I think there's a lot that parents can do to be on top of it and understand, you know, what they're going through, and that they need an exceptional amount of love. I had one of the big gedolim in Muncie, one of the great leaders in Muncie, a number of years ago. I did a talk for widows and divorcees and then divorced women, and I interviewed a few people that raised great kids, you know, despite having been divorced or widowed. And I asked them what the best practices were. And one of them told me that a gadol, a great Torah scholar in Muncie, the Talmud Chacham, told her that she should play music in her house all the time, that it should be have an upbeat tone. It was an extraordinary story. He said that, see that your house is upbeat and play music. He says, you have my permission to play music during Svira and during the 3 weeks when we typically don't play music because the Jewish people are mourning in some sort of availus. He said, your house has to be a happy place. So,
thank you. That's,
yeah,
that's
so, I'm sorry.
No, that's chashid. I like that. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. And it was actually very interesting. I went over to interview this woman. All her children were married. She had a son who was in his 30s. And because of Yichud, you know, I said, just one of your kids. She said, one of my kids will be there. So he asked if he could sit at the table and listen to my interview. So when I asked the mom, what were your best practices? She told me this, and the kid perked up. Kid, he was 30 then. He said, Mommy, was I in third grade when this happened? And she looked at him and she started counting. She says, yeah, why do you think that? She said, we all noticed that like the culture of the house changed very much. He didn't say, Mom, it looks like you're taking happy pills. but that's what he was really saying. And he said, we were talking about ourselves. We didn't really know why this happened. Now, in fairness, this Talmud Chacham may have told it to her because she was too harsh with the kids. I don't know. Right. So just to be fair, what he told her is, this is what he said. He said his quote was that every parents have to be a blend of din and rachamim, of judgment and mercy. He said, Hashem gave your family all the judgment they can handle. So it's your job to do just mercy.
Wow.
Any the kids can do anything they want? He said, no, but he said, ignore 9 out of 10. That's what he said. And he said,
thank you. That's gonna be really helpful.
I want to be clear. I obviously wasn't gonna ask her. She may have been particularly harsh with the kids, and maybe he heard something from one of the principals that said that, you know, came over to him and say, talk to her. I don't know. I only know what I saw, what I heard.
But the concept
is that, right, when you're in a situation, you'll see your children doing stuff like this. Thank you. I'm honored and glad that you found it meaningful. Thanks.
That's where it was coming from.
Right, changed, to realize that.
Changed the whole thing.
And that's part of the entropy, right?
Yeah.
Rav Abish, that's what you look for when you think of an answer key. You look around and you say, what's there and how can I figure this out? It doesn't make sense, but it makes sense somewhere. That's how I'm encouraging all of you to think with everything. And hopefully you come to realization. Anyone else, folks?
Okay, Siri Lamb, I'm unmuting you.
My Zoom Rebbitzin.
Hi. Just a quick question.
I asked you a Zoom question today, just so you know.
I work in a modern Orthodox school, but I send my kids to more right-wing schools. And the difference in all of those things where you talk about approach is so stark, because I see the level of communication that goes to parents. I know the level of training that I get and the way that it's enforced in the school that I get. And I guess my question is, practically as a parent, what is it that I can do or that I can encourage my friends to do to try to shift the trend, and almost in a more... in a really relevant parallel that I've seen is even everybody's approach to COVID and the ways that my kids' schools approached it, and the way that the school where I work approaches it. Exactly like that. I see the two almost being very similar. I don't know if it really is. And I just, again, I wonder practically what there is.
Alluded to earlier, I think Rav Alba would say that if you want to make change, it should be organic, right? Where rather than you walk in and say, you know, why aren't you doing this or that, try to do it more in a planting way than building, and try to offer your help. And, you know, you might want to, I don't know if it'll go over well if you say, well, in my school, they do this. You don't have to say that, but you say, look, I know that there's some training out there. How can I be of help? I really would like that. That's what I found. I know as the school principal, that would have worked with me. If a parent comes in and starts, you know, just jawboning, then you're a human being. You tend to just listen and you're respectful, you answer respectfully, but that's the best way to do it collaboratively, as far as where you feel most comfortable. And that's a very personal decision, you know, that families have to make, and that's just it. I'm saying this, it's if that's what you're noticing and that's how you're feeling, ultimately you try to change as best you can, and then you have to decide what's best for your family.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I don't have anything wiser to say than that. But look, I have noticed. I've noticed change. If I can find something in 10 seconds, I'll show it to you. I've noticed change, meaningful change. Maybe I shouldn't do this while. I want to show you something. One of my trustees has this on the wall in his office. Can you see this, folks? This is a picture of the principal of the Satmi Yeshiva reading our Yiddish child safety book to 350 students. I don't know if you can see it clearly enough. I went to Kiryas Yael, I went to Monroe when we started, we made a Yiddish copy of our safety book. I met with them and I said, look, I want to make a book that's matim for you. It's not about me, you can make any changes you want. We had a wonderful conversation. I'm not saying we saw eye to eye on reporting or all the other things. I said, look, we need to protect the children. I have something that works. What can we do to make it work? They took a few thousand books from us. And this was 6 years ago. Mrs. Lamb, you there?
I hear. I'm listening.
So I'm saying, I got Satma to do it. You can probably do something also. I'm saying it was really, it was an... And I thought about it a lot, and I went, you know, people tell me it's crazy, what are you doing, you're nuts, you're wasting your time, whatever, my friends. And I said, no, I'm gonna give it a whirl. And I was sincere, I meant it. I said, look, it's not about me, you can change. You should see the two books. A few of my friends bought the two books to change, you know, and we made it culturally congruent that it should look like a Satma family. And I did the same thing in Israel. We did it with the Dati Lumi community and with the Haredi community. Rav Chaim's daughter, she has 500 books at a time. We give her, she gives out books to everybody who comes. She's our biggest fan. So I'm saying you can, I don't think you should give up. I don't think you should give up. I think you should speak your truth nicely, politely, in a way that's helpful. Don't give up.
Thank you.
Sure.
Bacheva has her hand raised.
Okay, I think this is going to be the last one, folks. Go ahead, Bacheva, go.
Hi, thank you for letting me. A second question, that's because I'm so Word and not Excel that I didn't know how to raise my hands.
Well, actually, you must know. Yeah, go ahead, talk to Josh.
Okay, so my question is another question about my daughter. Because of she had a very difficult life, home circumstance. And she's very sensitive and shy, very bright though. And in terms of looking for a high school, like what are the things that I should zero in on and like as my priority and look away from? Like I know I should look for a place that's maybe smaller and more caring. And even if that comes with some kids that are not, I don't know, somehow it'll end up being with some girls that aren't as good. Unless Rabbi Horowitz is opening a high school, and you know,
not in this lifetime, not to the best of my knowledge. Okay. Look, I certainly can't, you know, I can't answer you specifically, but I do think you should look for a nurturing school. I think you should look if it's a choice. What would Maslow say? What would Maslow say? What do you think Maslow would say?
So the bottom two things, right?
I think so. What?
The bottom two parts have to be in place, right?
Don't you think he would say that? You say, yeah, but over there,
I'm saying the bottom parts have to be in place. She has to feel secure. She has to feel.
Especially her, but I would say anybody, right? Right. And that I think right. That's why I said I'm telling you Maslow's my Rebbe. I look at something, I automatically think like him. One last story that I didn't say earlier because there's a true story. It's a little, I don't know, funny is the right word, but somebody called me up. My mother was in the hospital sick, so it was 7-8 years ago. I didn't have the lowest level. I spent a few nights with my mother in the hospital, so I was pretty cratchy. I hadn't slept much. And this guy calls me up and he tells me that I'm good friends with him. And he tells me that his daughter, he just found out that his daughter who just came back from Israel was hanging out with, was hanging out with a guy for 11th grade, 12th grade, the whole year in Israel for 3 years. Neither parent knew about it. He didn't know, his wife didn't know. And he said, my daughter said she's getting engaged to him. And I said, over my dead body, and you know, whatever. So I said, the guy's a nothing, he's a bum, he did this, whatever. He mouthed off a little bit. So I sent him, I sent him a link to Maslow. I said, look, I'm with my mother right now. I said, you have an hour to look this over. I want you to study it like a Tosfos, like a, you know, a commentary on the Talmud, together with your wife, and then I'll talk to you for a few minutes, and that's it. So he calls me back. He says, yeah, I saw that. He explains. I said, you know, yeah, but what does that have to do? So I said, what did you tell your daughter again? He said, I told my daughter that you know, over my dead body, I'm never going to do it. So I said, Mazel Tov, when's the Vart? I promise you, I told it. I said, Mazel Tov, when's the engagement party? So he says, engagement party? Did you hear what I said? There's not going to be an engagement party. This guy's in it. So I said, congratulations. I said, just, you know, let me know when the... So he says, what are you talking about? So I said, look at Maslow. I said, your daughter has a level of security with him because she wants to spend a life with him. And you're saying you have to give up the guy, give up a two, or you're going to lose your family, which is a three. So Maslow would say, she's not giving him up for you because her future is with her husband. And if you say, if you make it in such stark terms, she's going to walk away. He said, yeah, she said something like that. And then I said, did you tell her that, did you put the guilt on that, you know, next week I have a slide about what works better, you know, guilt or trying to work positively. So he said, I said, did you tell her that your Holocaust surviving grandmother's going to have a heart attack because of this and die or anything like that? And he says, yeah, well, not exactly those words, but, you know. So I said, it's a Beferish Maslow. It's just, it's a, you know, Beferish is like, you know, written succinctly. I said, Maslow would say that she's not giving up a two for a three. So he says, so what should I do? So I said, why don't you tell her, listen, I don't know the kid yet. I never met him. I'm sure if you like him, he has very good qualities. So from now on, you're going to date him for 6 months. He comes in through the front door next time with a suit and a tie, and we'll get to know him. I swear to you, if everything goes well, we'll love him just like any other child of ours. And then you have a chance. Then you'll figure it out. Once you give her back the three and she doesn't have to fight for it. That was my take. So Maslow's everywhere. So I think that's how you think with your daughter in high school. I'm glad that you came to it on your own. Okay, folks?
Okay. Thank you.
See you next week. We have next week we're doing literally a deep dive. The bottom of the hidden part of the hidden part of the iceberg. Okay, we're going to get a lot done next week. I hope you found this helpful. I'm trying to find a way. I know many of you reached out to me for follow-up stuff. I'm trying to do some digital way of creating some sort of forum that I probably would not give out to the public, just for this group. So we could communicate with each other and you know, I could be able to jump in and ask some questions. If any of you are familiar with electronics and I looked up some forums, like I would love to be able to answer it in one place. And like this, I can do it when I have a few free minutes. So if anybody knows and is able to help, just drop me an email, please. I would love to be able to set up something that we should be able to communicate. Because I unfortunately apologize. I really can't do, you know, the rest of it. Hatzlach, everyone. Have a wonderful night. I'll see you in a week. Be well. Thank you again, Bela.